Dorda Mine began to vibrate. Nevertheless, he stuck around to watch the Korean conflict, where Ensign Stefanides served on a submarine chaser. We watched Milton's adult character forming during those years, taking on the no-nonsense attributes of our future father. The U.S. Navy was responsible for the precision with which Milton Stefanides ever after parted his hair, his habit of polishing his belt buckle with his shirt sleeves, his yes sirs and ship shapes, and his insistence on making us synchronize our watches at the mall. Under the brass eagle and fasces of his ensign's cap, Milton Stefanides left the Boy Scouts behind. The Navy gave him his love of sailing and his aversion to waiting in lines. Even then his politics were being formed, his anti-communism, his distrust of the Russians. Ports of call in Africa and Southeast Asia were already forging his beliefs about racial IQ levels. From the social snubs of his commanding officers, he was picking up his hatred of Eastern liberals and the Ivy League, at the same time as he was falling in love with Brooks Brothers clothing. His taste for tasseled loafers and seersucker shorts was seeping into him. We knew all this about our father before we were born, and then we forgot it and had to learn it all over again. When the Korean War ended in 1953, Milton was stationed again in Norfolk. And in March of 1954, as my father weighed his future, Chapter 11, with a little wave of farewell to me, raised his arms and traveled down the water slide into the world. And I was all alone. Events in the years before my birth. After dancing with Zoe at my parents' wedding, Father Mike pursued her doggedly for the next 2.5 years. Zoe didn't like the idea of marrying someone either so religious or so diminutive. Father Mike proposed to her 3 times, and in each case she refused, waiting for someone better to come along. But no one did. Finally, feeling that she had no alternative and coaxed by Desdemona, who still thought it was a wonderful thing to marry a priest, Zoe gave in. In 1949, she married Father Mike, and soon they went off to live in Greece. There she would give birth to 4 children, my cousins, and remain for the next 8 years. In Detroit in 1950, the Black Bottom Ghetto was bulldozed to put in a freeway. The Nation of Islam, now headquartered at Temple No. 2 in Chicago, got a new minister by the name of Malcolm X. During the winter of 1954, Desdemona first began to talk of retiring to Florida someday.
They have a city in Florida, you know what it is called? New Smyrna Beach.
In 1956, the last streetcar stopped running in Detroit and the Packard plant closed. And that same year, Milton Stefanides, tired of military life, left the Navy and returned home to pursue an old dream.
Oh, do something else, Lefty Stefanides told his son. They were in the zebra room drinking coffee. You go to the Naval Academy to be a bartender?
I don't want to be a bartender. I want to run a restaurant, a whole chain. This is a good place to start. Lefty shook his head. He leaned back and spread his arms, taking in the whole bar.
This is no place to start anything, he said.
He had a point. Despite my grandfather's assiduous drink refilling and counter wiping, the bar on Pingree Street had lost its luster. The old zebra skin, which he still had on the wall, had dried out and cracked. Cigarette smoke had dirtied the diamond shapes of the tin ceiling. Over the years, the zebra room had absorbed the exhalations of its auto worker patrons. The place smelled of their beer and hair tonic, their punch clock misery, their frayed nerves, their trade unionism. The neighborhood was also changing. When my grandfather had opened the bar in 1933, the area had been white and middle class. Now it was becoming poorer and predominantly black. In the inevitable chain of cause and effect, as soon as the first black family had moved on to the block, the white neighbors immediately put their houses up for sale. The oversupply of houses depressed the real estate prices, which allowed poorer people to move in, and with poverty came crime, and with crime came more moving vans.
Business isn't so good anymore, Lefty said. If you want to open a bar, try Greektown or Birmingham.
My father waved these objections aside. bar business isn't so good, maybe, he said. That's because there's too many bars around here, too much competition. What this neighborhood needs is a decent diner. Hercules Hot Dogs, which at its height would boast 66 locations throughout Michigan, Ohio, and southeastern Florida, each restaurant identified by the distinctive Pillars of Hercules out front, could be said to have begun on the snowy February morning in 1956 when my father arrived at the Zebra Room to begin renovations. The first thing he did was to remove the sagging Venetian blinds from the front windows to let in more light. He painted the interior a bright white. With a GI business loan, he had the bar remodeled into a diner counter and had a small kitchen installed. Workmen put red vinyl booths along the far wall and reupholstered the old bar stools with Zizmo's zebra skin. One morning, two delivery men carried a jukebox in the front door. And while hammers pounded and sawdust filled the air, Milton acquainted himself with the papers and deeds Lefty had haphazardly kept in a cigar box beneath the register. "What the hell is this?" he asked his father. "You got three insurance policies on this place."
"You can never have too much insurance," Lefty said.
"Sometimes the companies don't pay. Better to be sure." "Sure? Each one of these is for more than this place is worth. We're paying on all these. That's a waste of money."
Up until this point, Lefty had let his son make whatever changes he wanted, but now he stood firm.
"Listen to me, Milton. You haven't lived through a fire. You don't know what happens. Sometimes in a fire, the insurance company burns down, too. Then what can you do? But three. We need three," insisted Lefty.
"Just humor him," Tessie told Milton later that night. "Your parents have been through a lot."
"Sure, they've been through a lot, but we're the ones who have to keep paying these premiums."
Nevertheless, he did as his wife said and maintained all three policies. The Zebra Room I remember as a kid. It was full of artificial flowers, yellow tulips, red roses, dwarf trees bearing wax apples, plastic daisies sprouted from teapots, daffodils erupted from ceramic cows. Photos of Artie Shaw and Bing Crosby adorned the wall next to hand-painted signs that said, "Enjoy a nice lime Ricky, and our French toast is the toast of the town." There were photos of Milton putting a finishing touch cherry on a milkshake or kissing someone's baby like the mayor. There were photographs of actual mayors, Mariani and Kavanaugh. The great first baseman Al Kaline, who stopped in on his way to practice at Tiger Stadium, had autographed his own headshot. "To my pal Milt, great eggs." When a Greek Orthodox church in Flint burnt down, Milton drove up and salvaged one of the surviving stained glass windows. He hung it on the wall over the booths. Athena olive oil tins lined the front window next to a bust of Donizetti. Everything was hodgepodge. Grandmotherly lamps stood next to El Greco reproductions. Bull's horns hung from the neck of an Aphrodite statuette. Above the coffee maker, an assortment of figurines marched along the shelf. Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox, Mickey Mouse, Zeus, and Felix the Cat. My grandfather, trying to be of help, drove off one day and returned with a stack of 50 plates. "I already ordered plates," said Milton, "from a restaurant supply place. They're only charging us 10% down."
"You don't want these?" Lefty looked disappointed. "Okay, I'll take them back."
"Hey, Pop," his son called after him, "why don't you take the day off? I can handle things here."
"You don't need help?
Go home. Have Mom make you lunch." Lefty did as he was told. But as he drove down West Grand Boulevard, feeling unneeded, he passed Rubsaman Medical Supply, a store with dirty windows and a neon sign that blinked even in the day, and felt the stirrings of old temptation. The following Monday, Milton opened the new diner. He opened it at 6 in the morning with a newly hired staff of two, Eleni Papanikolas in a waitress uniform purchased at her own expense, and her husband Jimmy as short-order cook. "Remember, Eleni, you mostly work for tips," Milton pep-talked, "so smile."
"At who?"
asked Eleni. For despite the red carnations and bud vases gracing each booth, despite the zebra-striped menus, matchbooks, and napkins, the Zebra Room itself was empty.
Smart ass, Milton said, grinning. Eleni's ribbing didn't bother him. He'd worked it all out. He'd found a need and filled it. In the interest of time, I offer you now a stock capitalist montage. We see Milton greeting his first customers. We see Eleni serving them scrambled eggs. We see Milton and Eleni standing back, biting their lips. But now the customers are smiling and nodding. Eleni runs to refill their coffee. Next, Milton, in different clothes, is greeting more customers, and Jimmy the cook is cracking eggs one-handed, and Lefty is looking left out. Give me 2 fried whiskey down, Milton shouts, showing off his new lingo. Dry white 68, hold the ice. Close up of the cash register, ringing open and closed, of Milton's hands counting money, of Lefty putting on his hat and leaving unnoticed, then more eggs, eggs being cracked, fried, flipped, and scrambled, eggs arriving in cartons through the back door and coming out on plates through the front hatch, fluffy heaps of scrambled eggs in gleaming yellow technicolor, and the cash register banging open again and money piling up until finally we see Milton and Tessie dressed in their best following a real estate agent through a big house. The neighborhood of Indian Village lay just 12 blocks west of Hurlbut, but it was a different world altogether. The 4 grand streets of Burns, Iroquois, Seminole, and Adams, even in Indian Village the white men had taken half the names, were lined with stately houses built in eclectic styles. Red brick Georgian rose next to English Tudor, which gave on to French provincial. The houses in Indian Village had big yards, important walkways, picturesquely oxidizing cupolas, lawn jockeys whose days were numbered, and burglar alarms, whose popularity was only just beginning. My grandfather remained silent, however, as he toured his son's impressive new home. How do you like the size of this living room? Milton was asking him. Here, sit down. Make yourself comfortable. Tessie and I want you and Ma to feel like this is your house, too, now that you're retired. What do you mean, retired? Okay, semi-retired. Now that you can take it a little bit easy, you'll be able to do all the things you always wanted to do. Look, and here's the library. You want to come over and work on your translations? You can do it right here. How about that table? Big enough for you, and the shelves are built right into the wall. Pushed out of the daily operations at the Zebra Room, my grandfather began to spend his days driving around the city. He drove downtown to the public library to read the foreign newspapers. Afterward, he stopped to play backgammon at a coffee house in Greektown. At 54, Lefty Stefanides was still in good shape. He walked 3 miles a day for exercise. He ate sensibly and had less of a belly than his son. Nevertheless, time was making its inevitable depredations. Lefty had to wear bifocals now. He had a touch of bursitis in his shoulder. His clothes had gone out of style so that he looked like an extra in a gangster movie. One day, appraising himself with severity in the bathroom mirror, Lefty realized that he had become one of those older men who slicked their hair back in allegiance to an era no one could remember. Depressed by this fact, Lefty gathered up his books. He drove over to Seminole, intending to use the library, but when he got to the house, he kept on going. With a wild look in his eyes, he headed instead for Rupsaman Medical Supply. Once you've visited the underworld, you never forget the way back. Forever after, you're able to spot the red light in the upstairs window, or the champagne glass on the door that doesn't open until midnight. For years now, driving past Rupsaman Medical Supply, my grandfather had noticed the unchanging window display of hernia truss, neck brace, and crutches. He'd seen the desperate, crazily hopeful faces of the Negro men and women who went in and out without buying a thing. My grandfather recognized that desperation and knew that now, in his forced retirement, this was the place for him. Roulette wheels spun behind Lefty's eyes as he sped toward the west side. The clicking of backgammon dice filled his ears as he pressed the accelerator. His blood grew hot with an old excitement, a quickening of the pulse he hadn't felt since descending the mountain to explore the back streets of Bursa. He parked at the curb and hurried inside. He walked past the startled customers, who weren't used to seeing white people. He strode past the props of aspirin bottles, corn plasters, and laxatives, and went up to the pharmacist's window in the rear. "Can I help you?" the pharmacist asked. 22, said Lefty. "You got it?"
Trying to reclaim the drama of his gambling days, my grandfather started playing the West Side numbers. He started small, little bets of $2 or $3. After a few weeks, to recoup his losses, he went up to $10. Every day he wagered a piece of the new profits from the restaurant. One day he won, and so went double or nothing the next, and lost. Amid hot water bottles and enema bags, he placed his bets. Surrounded by cough medicine and cold sore ointment, he started playing a gig, meaning three numbers at once. As they had in Bursa, his pockets filled up with scraps of paper. He wrote out lists of the numbers he played, along with the dates, so as not to repeat any. He played Milton's birthday, Desdemona's birthday, the date of Greek independence minus the last digit, the year of the burning of Smyrna. Desdemona, finding the scraps in the wash, thought they had to do with the new restaurant. "My husband, the millionaire," she said, dreaming of Florida retirement. For the first time ever, Lefty consulted Desdemona's dream book in the hope of calculating a winning number on the abacus of his unconscious. He became alert to the integers that appeared in his dreams. Many of the Negroes who frequented Rubsaman's medical supply noticed my grandfather's preoccupation with the dream book, and after he won for 2 weeks in a row, word spread. This led to the only contribution Greeks have ever made to African-American culture, aside from the wearing of gold medallions, as the blacks of Detroit began to buy dream books themselves. The Atlantis Publishing Company translated the books into English and shipped them to major cities all over America. For a short time, elderly colored women began to hold the same superstitions my grandmother did, believing, for instance, that a running rabbit meant you were coming into money, or that a black bird on a telephone line augured that somebody was about to die. "Taking that money to the bank?" Milton asked, seeing his father empty the cash register.
"Yes, to the bank."
And Lefty did go to the bank. He went to withdraw money from his savings account in order to continue his steady assault on all 999 possible permutations of a three-digit variable. Whenever he lost, he felt awful. He wanted to stop. He wanted to go home and confess to Desdemona. The only antidote to this feeling, however, was the prospect of winning the next day. It's possible that a hint of self-destructiveness played a part in my grandfather's numbers playing. Full of survivor's guilt, he was surrendering himself to the random forces of the universe, trying to punish himself for still being alive. But mostly, gambling just filled his empty days. I alone, from the private box of my primordial egg, saw what was going on. Milton was too busy running the diner to notice. Tessie was too busy taking care of Chapter 11 to notice. Sormelina might have noticed something, but she didn't make many appearances at our house during those years. In 1953, at a Theosophical Society meeting, Aunt Lena had met a woman named Mrs. Evelyn Watson. Mrs. Watson had been attracted to the Theosophical Society by the hope of contacting her deceased husband, but soon lost interest in communicating with the spirit world in favor of whispering with Sormelina in the flesh. With shocking speed, Aunt Lena had quit her job at the florist shop and moved down to the southwest with Mrs. Watson. Every Christmas since, she sent my parents a gift box containing hot sauce, a flowering cactus, and a photograph of Mrs. Watson and herself in front of some national monument. One surviving photo shows the couple in an Anasazi ceremonial cave at Bandelier, Mrs. Watson looking as wisely lined as Georgia O'Keeffe, while Lena, in a tremendous sun hat, descends a ladder into a kiva. As for Desdemona, during the mid to late 50s, she was experiencing a brief and completely uncharacteristic spell of contentment. Her son had returned unhurt from another war. St. Christopher had kept his word during the police action in Korea, and Milton hadn't been so much as fired on. Her daughter-in-law's pregnancy had caused the usual anxiety, of course, but Chapter 11 had been born healthy. The restaurant was doing well. Every week, family and friends gathered at Milton's new house in Indian Village for Sunday dinner. One day, Desdemona received a brochure from the New Smyrna Beach Chamber of Commerce, which she had sent away for. It didn't look like Smyrna at all, but at least it was sunny and there were fruit stands. Meanwhile, my grandfather was feeling lucky. Having played at least one number every day for a little over 2 years, he had now bet on every number from 1 to 740. Only 159 numbers to go to reach 999. Then what? What else? Start over. Bank tellers handed rolls of money to Lefty, which he in turn handed to the pharmacist behind the window. He played 741, 742, and 743. He played 744, 745, and 746. And then one morning, the bank teller informed Lefty that there weren't sufficient funds in his account to make a withdrawal. The teller showed him his balance, $13.26. My grandfather thanked the teller. He crossed the bank lobby, adjusting his tie. He felt suddenly dizzy. The gambling fever he'd had for 26 months broke, sending a last wave of heat over his skin, and suddenly his entire body was dripping wet. Mopping his brow, Lefty walked out of the bank into his penniless old age. The ear-splitting cry my grandmother let out when she learned of the disaster cannot be done justice in print. The shriek went on and on as she tore her hair and rent her garments and collapsed onto the floor. "How will we eat?" Desdemona wailed, staggering around the kitchen. "Where will we live?" She spread her arms, appealing to God, then beat her chest and finally took hold of her left sleeve and ripped it off. "What kind of husband are you to do this to your wife who cooked and cleaned for you and gave you children and never complained?" Now she tore off her right sleeve. "Didn't I tell you not to gamble? Didn't I?" She started on her dress proper now. She took the hem in her hands as ancient Near Eastern ululations issued from her throat. "Oh, lo, 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 lo. Oh, lo, 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 lo." My grandfather watched in astonishment as his modest wife shredded her clothing before his eyes, the skirt of the dress, the waist, the bosom, the neckline, with a final rip. The dress split in two, and Desdemona lay on the linoleum, exposing to the world the misery of her underwear, her overburdened underwire brassiere, her gloomy underpants, and the frantic girdle whose stays she was even now popping as she approached the summit of her dishevelment. But at last she stopped. Before she was completely naked, Desdemona fell back as though depleted. She pulled off her hairnet, and her hair spilled out to cover her, and she closed her eyes, spent. In the next moment, she said in a practical tone, "Now, we have to move in with Milton." 3 weeks later, in October 1958, my grandparents moved out of Hurlbut 1 year before they would have paid off the mortgage. Over a warm Indian summer weekend, my father and dishonored grandfather carried furniture outside for the yard sale, the sea foam green sofa and armchairs, which still looked brand new beneath plastic slip covers, the kitchen table, the bookcases. Lamps were set out on the grass, along with Milton's old Boy Scout manuals, Zoe's dolls and tap shoes, a framed photograph of Patriarch Athenagoras, and a closet full of Lefty's suits, which my grandmother forced him to sell as punishment. Hair safely restored beneath her hairnet, Desdemona glowered around the yard, submerged in a despair too deep for tears. She examined each object, sighing audibly before affixing a price tag, and scolded her husband for trying to carry things too heavy for him. "Do you think you're young? Let Milton do it. You're an old man." Under one arm she held the silkworm box, which wasn't for sale. When she saw the portrait of the patriarch, she gasped in horror. "We don't have bad luck enough. You want to sell the patriarch?" She snatched it up and carried it inside. For the rest of the day, she remained in the kitchen, unable to watch the miscellaneous horde of yard sale scavengers pick over her personal possessions. There were weekend antiquers from the suburbs who brought their dogs along, and families down on their luck who roped chairs to the roofs of battered cars, and discriminating male couples who turned everything over to search for trademarks on the bottom. Desdemona would have felt no more ashamed had she herself been for sale, displayed naked on the green sofa, a price tag hanging from her foot. When everything had been sold or given away, Milton drove my grandparents' remaining belongings in a rented truck the 12 blocks to Seminole. In order to give them privacy, my grandparents were offered the attic. Risking injury, my father and Jimmy Papanicolas carried everything up the secret stairway behind the wallpapered door. Up into the peaked space, they carted my grandparents' disassembled bed, the leather ottoman, the brass coffee table, and Lefty's Rebetika records. Trying to make up with his wife, my grandfather brought home the first of the many parakeets my grandparents would have over the years, and gradually, living on top of us all, Desdemona and Lefty made their next-to-last home together. For the next 9 years, Desdemona complained of the cramped quarters and of the pain in her legs when she descended the stairs. But every time my father offered to move her downstairs, she refused. In my opinion, she enjoyed the attic because the vertigo of living up there reminded her of Mount Olympus. The dormer window provided a good view, not of Sultan's tombs, but of the Edison factory, and when she left the window open, the wind blew through it as it used to do in Vithinios. Up in the attic, Desdemona and Lefty came back to where they started. As does my story. Because now Chapter 11, my 5-year-old brother, and Jimmy Papanicolas are each holding a red egg, dyed the color of the blood of Christ. More eggs fill a bowl on the dining room table. Red eggs are lined along the mantle. They hang in string pouches over doorways. Zeus liberated all living things from an egg, ex ovo omnia. The white flew up to become the sky. The yolk descended into earth. And on Greek Easter, we still play the egg-cracking game. Jimmy Papanicolas holds his egg out passive as Chapter 11 rams his egg against it. Always only one egg cracks. I win, shouts Chapter 11. Now Milton selects an egg from the bowl. This looks like a good one. Built like a Brinks truck, he holds it out. Chapter 11 prepares to ram it. But before anything happens, my mother taps my father on the back. She has a thermometer in her mouth. As dinner dishes are cleared from the table downstairs, my parents ascend hand in hand to their bedroom. As Desdemona cracks her egg against Lefty's, my parents shuck off a strict minimum of clothing. As Sor Melina, back from New Mexico for the holidays, plays the egg game with Mrs. Watson, my father lets out a small groan, rolls sideways off my mother, and declares, "That should do it." The bedroom grows still. Inside my mother, a billion sperm swim upstream, males in the lead. They carry not only instructions about eye color, height, nose shape, enzyme production, macrophage resistance, but a story too. Against a black background they swim, a long, white, silken thread spinning itself out. The thread began on a day 250 years ago, when the biology gods, for their own amusement, monkeyed with a gene on a baby's 5th chromosome. That baby passed the mutation on to her son, who passed it on to his 2 daughters, who passed it on to 3 of their children, my great-great-greats, etc., until finally it ended up in the bodies of my grandparents. Hitching a ride, the gene descended a mountain and left a village behind. It got trapped in a burning city and escaped, speaking bad French. Crossing the ocean, it faked a romance, circled a ship's deck, and made love in a lifeboat. It had its braids cut off. It took a train to Detroit and moved into a house on Hurlbut. It consulted dream books and opened an underground speakeasy. It got a job at Temple No. 1. And then the gene moved on again into new bodies. It joined the Boy Scouts and painted its toenails red. It played Begin the Begin out the back window. It went off to war and stayed at home watching newsreels. It took an entrance exam, posed like the movie magazines, received a death sentence, and made a deal with St. Christopher. It dated a future priest and broke off an engagement. It was saved by a bosun's chair. always moving ahead, rushing along. Only a few more curves left in the track now. Annapolis and a submarine chaser. Until the biology gods knew this was their time. This was what they'd been waiting for. And as a spoon swung and a ya-ya worried, my destiny fell into place. On March 20th, 1954, Chapter 11 arrived, and the biology gods shook their heads. Nope, sorry. But there was still time. Everything was in place. The roller coaster was in free fall, and there was no stopping it now. My father was seeing visions of little girls, and my mother was praying to a Christ pantocrator she didn't entirely believe in until finally, right this minute, on Greek Easter, 1959, it's about to happen. The gene is about to meet its twin. As sperm meets egg, I feel a jolt. There's a loud sound, a sonic boom as my world cracks. I feel myself shift, already losing bits of my prenatal omniscience, tumbling toward the blank slate of personhood. With the shred of all-knowingness I have left, I see my grandfather, Lefty Stefanides, on the night of my birth 9 months from now, turning a demi-tasse cup upside down on a saucer. I see his coffee grounds forming a sign as pain explodes in his temple and he topples to the floor. Again, the sperm rams my capsule. And I realize I can't put it off any longer. The lease on my terrific little apartment is finally up, and I'm being evicted. So I raise one fist, male typically, and begin to beat on the walls of my eggshell until it cracks. Then, slippery as a yolk, I dive headfirst into the world. "I'm sorry, little baby girl," my mother said in bed, touching her belly and already speaking to me. "I wanted it to be more romantic." "You want romantic?" said my father. "Where's my clarinet?" Book 3, Home Movies. My eyes, switched on at last, saw the following. A nurse reaching out to take me from the doctor. My mother's triumphant face as big as Mount Rushmore as she watched me heading for my first bath. I said it was impossible, but still I remember it. Also other things, material and immaterial. The relentless glare of OR lights. White shoes squeaking over white floors. A housefly contaminating gauze. And all around me, up and down the halls of women's hospital, individual dramas underway. I could sense the happiness of couples holding first babies and the fortitude of Catholics accepting their ninth. I could feel one young mother's disappointment at the reappearance of her husband's weak chin on the face of her newborn daughter, and a new father's terror as he calculated the tuition for triplets. On the floors above delivery in flowerless rooms, women lay recovering from hysterectomies and mastectomies. Teenage girls with burst ovarian cysts nodded out on morphine. It was all around me from the beginning, the weight of female suffering with its biblical justification and vanishing acts. The nurse who cleaned me up was named Rosalie. She was a pretty, long-faced woman from the Tennessee mountains. After suctioning the mucus from my nostrils, she gave me a shot of vitamin K to coagulate my blood. Inbreeding is common in Appalachia, as are genetic deformities, but Nurse Rosalie noticed nothing unusual about me. She was concerned about a purple splotch on my cheek, thinking it was a port wine stain. It turned out to be placenta and washed off. Nurse Rosalie carried me back to Dr. Philibosian for an anatomical exam. She placed me down on the table, but kept one hand on me for security's sake. She'd noticed the doctor's hand tremor during the delivery. In 1960, Dr. Nishan Philibosian was 74. He had a camel's head drooping on its neck, with all the activity in the cheeks. White hair surrounded his otherwise bald head in a nimbus and plugged his big ears like cotton. His surgeon's eyeglasses had rectangular loops attached. He began with my neck, searching for cretinous folds. He counted my fingers and toes. He inspected my palate. He noted my Moro reflex without surprise. He checked my backside for a sacral tail. Then, putting me on my back again, he took hold of each of my curved legs and pulled them apart. What did he see? The clean, saltwater muscle of the female genitalia. The area inflamed, swollen with hormones, that touch of the baboon all babies have. Dr. Philipposian would have had to pull the folds apart to see any better, but he didn't, because right at that instant, Nurse Rosalie, for whom the moment was also destiny, accidentally touched his arm. Dr. Phil looked up. Presbyopic Armenian eyes met middle-aged Appalachian ones. The gaze lingered, then broke away. 5 minutes old, and already the themes of my life, chance and sex, announced themselves. Nurse Rosalie blushed.
Beautiful, Dr. Philipposian said, meaning me, but looking at his assistant. A beautiful, healthy girl.
On Seminole, the birth celebrations were tempered by the prospect of death. Desdemona had found Lefty on our kitchen floor, lying next to his overturned coffee cup. She knelt beside him and pressed an ear to his chest. When she heard no heartbeat, she cried out his name. Her wail echoed off the kitchen's hard surfaces, the toaster, the oven, the refrigerator. Finally, she collapsed on his chest. In the silence that followed, however, Desdemona felt a strange emotion rising inside her. It spread in the space between her panic and grief. It was like a gas inflating her. Soon her eyes snapped open as she recognized the emotion. It was happiness. Tears were running down her face. She was already berating God for taking her husband from her, but on the other side of these proper emotions was an altogether improper relief. The worst had happened. This was it, the worst thing. For the first time in her life, my grandmother had nothing to worry about. Emotions, in my experience, aren't covered by single words. I don't believe in sadness, joy, or regret. Maybe the best proof that the language is patriarchal is that it oversimplifies feeling. I'd like to have at my disposal complicated hybrid emotions, Germanic train car constructions like, say, the happiness that attends disaster, or the disappointment of sleeping with one's fantasy. I'd like to show how intimations of mortality brought on by aging family members connects with the hatred of mirrors that begins in middle age. I'd like to have a word for the sadness inspired by failing restaurants, as well as for the excitement of getting a room with a minibar. I've never had the right words to describe my life. And now that I've entered my story, I need them more than ever. I can't just sit back and watch from a distance anymore. From here on in, everything I'll tell you is colored by the subjective experience of being part of events. Here's where my story splits, divides, undergoes meiosis. Already the world feels heavier. Now I'm a part of it. I'm talking about bandages and sopped cotton, the smell of mildew in movie theaters, and of all the lousy cats in their stinking litter boxes, of rain on city streets when the dust comes up and the old Italian men take their folding chairs inside. Up until now, it hasn't been my world, not my America. But here we are, at last. The happiness that attends disaster didn't possess Desdemona for long. A few seconds later, she returned her head to her husband's chest and heard his heart beating. Lefty was rushed to the hospital. 2 days later, he regained consciousness. His mind was clear, his memory intact. But when he tried to ask whether the baby was a boy or a girl, he found he was unable to speak. According to Julie Kikuchi, beauty is always freakish. Yesterday, over strudel and coffee at Café Einstein, she tried to prove this to me. "Look at this model," she said, holding up a fashion magazine. "Look at her ears. They belong on a Martian." She started flipping pages. "Well, look at the mouth on this one. You could put your whole head in it." I was trying to get another cappuccino. The waiters in their Austrian uniforms ignored me, as they do everyone, and outside the yellow lindens were dripping and weeping. "Well, what about Jackie O?" said Julie, still advocating. "Her eyes were so wide-set they were basically on the sides of her head. She looked like a hammerhead." I'm working up, with the foregoing, to a physical description of myself. Baby pictures of the infant Calliope show a variety of features on the freakish side. My parents, looking fondly down into my crib, got stuck on every one. I sometimes think that it was the arresting, slightly disturbing quality of my face that distracted everyone's attention from the complications below. Imagine my crib as a diorama in a museum. Press one button, and my ears light up like two golden trumpets. Press another, and my stark chin begins to glow. Another, and the high, ethereal cheekbones appear out of the darkness. So far, the effect isn't promising. On the evidence of ears, chin, and cheekbones, I might be a baby Kafka. But the next button illuminates my mouth. And things begin to improve. The mouth is small but well-shaped, kissable, musical. Then, in the middle of the map, comes the nose. It is nothing like the noses you see in classical Greek sculpture. Here is a nose that came to Asia Minor, like silk itself, from the East. In this case, the Middle East. The nose of the diorama baby already forms, if you look closely, an arabesque. Ears, nose, mouth, chin, now eyes. Not only are they widely set like Jackie O's, they're big, too big for a baby's face. Eyes like my grandmother's. Eyes as big and sad as the eyes in a Keane painting. Eyes rimmed with long, dark eyelashes my mother couldn't believe had formed inside her. How had her baby worked in such detail? The complexion around these eyes, a pale olive. The hair, jet black. Now press all the buttons at once. Can you see me, all of me? Probably not. No one ever really has. As a baby, even as a little girl, I possessed an awkward, extravagant beauty. No single feature was right in itself, and yet, when they were taken all together, something captivating emerged. An inadvertent harmony. A changeableness, too, as if beneath my visible face there was another, having second thoughts. Desdemona wasn't interested in my looks. She was concerned with the state of my soul. "The baby, she is 2 months old," she said to my father in March. "Why you still no baptize her?" "I don't want her baptized," answered Milton. "It's a bunch of hocus-pocus." "Hokey-pokey, is it?" Desdemona now threatened him with an index finger. "You think holy tradition that the church keep for 2,000 years is hokey-pokey?" And then she called on the Panagia, using every one of her names. "All holy, immaculate, most blessed and glorified Lady, Mother of God and ever Virgin, do you hear what my son Milton is saying?" When my father still refused, Desdemona unleashed her secret weapon. She started fanning herself. To anyone who never personally experienced it, it's difficult to describe the ominous storm-gathering quality of my grandmother's fanning. Refusing to argue any more with my father, she walked on swollen ankles into the sunroom. She sat down in a cane chair by the window. The winter light coming from the side reddened the far translucent wing of her nose. She picked up her cardboard fan. The front of the fan was emblazoned with the words, "Turkish atrocities." Below, in smaller print, were the specifics.
the 1955 pogrom in Istanbul, in which 15 Greeks were killed, 200 Greek women raped, 4,348 stores looted, 59 Orthodox churches destroyed, and even the graves of the patriarchs desecrated. Desdemona had 6 atrocity fans. They were a collector's set. Each year, she set a contribution to the Patriarchate in Constantinople. And a few weeks later, a new fan arrived, making claims of genocide, and in one case, bearing a photograph of Patriarch Athenagoras in the ruins of a looted cathedral. Not appearing on Desdemona's particular fan that day, but denounced nonetheless, was the most recent crime committed not by the Turks, but by her own Greek son, who refused to give his daughter a proper Orthodox baptism. Desdemona's fanning wasn't a matter of moving the wrist back and forth. The agitation came from deep within her. It originated from the spot between her stomach and liver where she once told me the Holy Spirit resided. It issued from a place deeper than her own buried crime. Milton tried to take shelter behind his newspaper, but the fan-disturbed air rustled the newsprint. The force of Desdemona's fanning could be felt all over the house. It swirled dust balls on the stairs. It stirred the window shades. And, of course, since it was winter, it made everyone shiver. After a while, the entire house seemed to be hyperventilating. The fanning even pursued Milton into his Oldsmobile, which began to make a soft hissing from the radiator. In addition to the fanning, my grandmother appealed to family feeling. Father Mike, her son-in-law, and my very own uncle, was by this time back from his years in Greece and serving, in an assistant capacity, at Assumption Greek Orthodox Church. "Please, Milty," Desdemona said. "Think of Father Mike. They never give him top job at the church. You think if his Onishino gets baptized, it will look good? Think of your sister, Milty, poor Zoe. They not have much money."
Finally, in a sign that he was weakening, my father asked my mother, "What do they charge for a baptism these days?"
"They're free."
Milton's eyebrows lifted, but after a moment's consideration, he nodded, confirmed in his suspicions. "Figures, they let you in for free, then you gotta pay for the rest of your life."
By 1960, the Greek Orthodox congregation of Detroit's East Side had yet another new building to worship in. Assumption had moved from Verner Highway to a new site on Charlevoix. The erection of the Charlevoix Church had been an event of great excitement. From the humble beginnings of the storefront on Hart Street to the respectable but by no means splashy domicile off Beneteau, Assumption was finally going to get a grand church building. Many construction firms bid for the job, but in the end it was decided to give it to someone from the community, and that someone was Bart Skiotis. The motives behind building the new church were twofold: to resurrect the ancient splendor of Byzantium and to show the world the financial wherewithal of the prospering Greek-American community. No expense was spared. An icon painter from Crete was imported to render the iconography. He stayed for over a year, sleeping in the unfinished structure on a thin mat. A traditionalist, he refrained from meat, alcohol, and sweets in order to purify his soul and receive divine inspiration. Even his paintbrush was by the book, made from the tip of a squirrel's tail. Slowly, over 2 years, our East Side Hagia Sophia went up, not far from the Ford Freeway. There was only one problem. Unlike the icon painter, Bart Skiotis had not worked with a pure heart. It turned out that he had used inferior materials, siphoning the remaining cash into his personal bank account. He laid the foundation incorrectly, so it wasn't long before cracks began to branch over the walls, scarring the iconography. The ceiling leaked, too. Within the substandard construction of the Charlevoix Church, literally upon a shaky foundation, I was baptized into the Orthodox faith, a faith that had existed long before Protestantism
had anything to protest, and before Catholicism called itself Catholic. A faith that stretched back to the beginnings of Christianity, when it was Greek and not Latin, and which, without an Aquinas to reify it, had remained shrouded in the smoke of tradition and mystery whence it began. My godfather, Jimmy Papanicolas, took me from my father's arms. He presented me to Father Mike, smiling, overjoyed to be center stage for once. Father Mike cut a lock of my hair and tossed it into the baptismal pool. It was this part of the ritual, I later suspected, that was responsible for the fuzzy quality of our font surfaces, years and years of baby hair, stimulated by the life-giving water, had taken root and grown. But now Father Mike was ready for the dunking. "The servant of God, Calliope Helen, is baptized in the name of the Father. Amen." And he pushed me under for the first time. In the Orthodox Church, we don't go in for partial immersion. No sprinkling, no forehead dabbing for us. In order to be reborn, you have to be buried first. So under the water I went. My family looked on, my mother seized with anxiety. What if I inhaled? My brother dropping a penny into the water when no one was looking. My grandmother stilling her fan for the first time in weeks. Father Mike pulled me up into the air again. "End of the Son. Amen." And dunked me under once more. This time I opened my eyes. Chapter 11's penny, in free fall, glinted through the murk. Down it sank to the bottom, where I now noticed lots of things were collected. Other coins, for instance, hairpins, somebody's old band-aid. In the green, scummy, holy water, I felt at peace. Everything was silent. The sides of my neck tingled in the place where humans once had gills. I was dimly aware that this beginning was somehow indicative of the rest of my life. My family were around me. I was in the hands of God. But I was in my own separate element, too, submerged in rare sensations, pushing evolution's envelope. This knowledge whizzed through my mind, and then Father Mike pulled me up again. "End of the Holy Spirit. Amen." One more dunking to go. Down I went and back up again into light and air. The three submersions had taken a while. In addition to being murky, the water was warm. By the third time up, therefore, I had indeed been reborn as a fountain. From between my cherubic legs, a stream of crystalline liquid shot into the air. Lit from the dome above, its yellow scintillance arrested everyone's attention. The stream rose in an arc. Propelled by a full bladder, it cleared the lip of the font, and before my Nuno had time to react, it struck Father Mike right in the middle of the face. Suppressed laughter from the pews, a few old ladies gasping in horror, then silence. Disgraced by his own partial immersion, and dabbing himself like a Protestant, Father Mike completed the ceremony. Taking the chrism on his fingertips, he anointed me, making the sign of the cross on the required places, first my forehead, then eyes, nostrils, mouth, ears, breast, hands, and feet. As he touched each place, he said, "The seal of the gift of the Holy Spirit." Finally, he gave me my first communion, with one exception. Father Mike didn't forgive me for my sin. "That's my girl," Milton crowed on the way home. "Pissed on a priest." "It was an accident," Tessie insisted, still hot with embarrassment. "Poor Father Mike, he'll never get over it." "That went really far," marveled Chapter 11. In all the commotion, no one wondered about the engineering involved. Desdemona took my reverse baptism of her son-in-law as a bad omen. Already potentially responsible for her husband's stroke, I had now committed a sacrilege at my first liturgical opportunity. In addition, I had humiliated her by being born a girl. "Maybe you should try guessing the weather," Sormelina teased her. My father rubbed it in. "So much for your spoon, Ma. Sort of pooped out on you." The truth was that in those days, Desdemona was struggling against assimilationist pressures she couldn't resist. Though she had lived in America as an eternal exile, a visitor for 40 years, certain bits of her adopted country had been seeping under the locked doors of her disapproval. After Lefty came home from the hospital, my father took a TV up to the attic to provide some entertainment. It was a small black-and-white Zenith prone to vertical shift. Milton placed it on a bedside table and went back downstairs. The television remained rumbling, glowing. Lefty adjusted his pillows to watch. Desdemona tried to do housework, but found herself looking over at the screen more and more often. She still didn't like cars. She covered her ears whenever the vacuum cleaner was on, but the TV was somehow different. My grandmother took to television right away. It was the first and only thing about America she approved of. Sometimes she forgot to turn the set off and would awaken at 2 a.m. to hear the Star-Spangled Banner playing before the station signed off. The television replaced the sound of conversation that was missing from my grandparents' lives. Desdemona watched all day long, scandalized by the love affairs on As the World Turns. She liked detergent commercials especially, anything with animated scrubbing bubbles or avenging suds. Living on Seminole contributed to the cultural imperialism. On Sundays, instead of serving metaxa, Milton fixed cocktails for his guests.
"Drinks with the names of people," Desdemona complained to her mute husband back in the attic. "Tom Collins, Harvey Wallbang. This is a drink? And they are listening to music on the, how you say, the hi-fi. Milton, he puts this music and they drink Tom Collins, and sometimes they are, you know, dancing one-on-one, men together with the women. Like wrestling."
What was I to Desdemona but another sign of the end of things? She tried not to look at me. She hid behind her fans. Then one day Tessie had to go out, and Desdemona was forced to babysit. Warily, she entered my bedroom. Taking cautious steps, she approached my crib. Black-draped sexagenarian leaned down to examine pink-swaddled infant. Maybe something in my expression set off an alarm. Maybe she was already making the connections she would later make between village babies and this suburban one, between old wives' tales and new endocrinology. Then again, maybe not. Because as she peered distrustfully over the rail of my crib, she saw my face. And blood intervened. Desdemona's worried expression hovered above my similarly perplexed one. Her mournful eyes gazed down at my equally large black orbs. Everything about us was the same, and so she picked me up, and I did what grandchildren are supposed to do. I erased the years between us. I gave Desdemona back her original skin. From then on, I was her favorite. Mid-mornings, she would relieve my mother by taking me up to the attic. Lefty had regained most of his strength by this time. Despite his speech paralysis, my grandfather remained a vital person. He got up early every day, bathed, shaved, and put on a necktie to translate attic Greek for 2 hours before breakfast. He no longer had aspirations to publish his translations, but did the work because he liked it and because it kept his mind sharp. In order to communicate with the rest of the family, he kept a little chalkboard with him at all times. He wrote messages in words and personal hieroglyphics. Aware that he and Desdemona were a burden to my parents, Lefty was extremely helpful around the house, doing repairs, assisting with the cleaning, running errands. Every afternoon, he took his 3-mile walk, no matter the weather, and returned cheerful. His smile full of gold fillings. At night, he listened to his Rebetika records in the attic and smoked his hookah pipe. Whenever Chapter 11 asked what was in the pipe, Lefty wrote on his chalkboard, "Turkish mud." My parents always believed it was an aromatic brand of tobacco. Where Lefty obtained the hash is anybody's guess. Out on his walks, probably. Still had lots of Greek and Lebanese contacts in the city. From 10 to noon every day, my grandparents took care of me. Desdemona fed me my bottles and changed my diapers. She finger-combed my hair. When I got fussy, Lefty carried me around the room. Since he couldn't speak to me, he bounced me a lot and hummed to me and touched his big arching nose to my little latent one. My grandfather was like a dignified, unpainted mime. And I was almost five before I realized that anything was wrong with him. When he tired of making faces, he carried me to the dormer window, where together, from the opposite ends of life, we gazed down at our leafy neighborhood. Soon, I was walking. Animated by brightly wrapped presents, I scampered into the frames of my father's home movies. On those first celluloid Christmases, I look as overdressed as